I was living in Buffalo, New York, and I had been arrested at the age of 18 for an attempted robbery. I was living in the streets, and I was basically a homeless person. And out of pure desperation, in the middle of the winter, I decided to pull a stick up. I'd never tried a stick up in my life before. And I thought I saw this woman in this store. I thought it was an easy mom and pop type deal, and I could get a couple $100 or something. And at that point, try to get a bottle of Southern Comfort and kind of keep myself warm, you know, at night. So I walked into the store, and I didn't even have a weapon, and I put my finger in my pocket, and I said, "Stick 'em up, and this is a robbery." And she turned around and kind of laughed at me, right? And it was an Italian woman, and the next thing she screamed for her brothers, and they come running down the stairs, and I was trying to run out the store, and I slipped on the ice, and then they jumped on me, and they just started pounding me. But before the police got there, they asked me, "Well, why did you do this?" And I said, basically, because I was hungry, and I was living in the streets. And I was given a court-appointed attorney, because I couldn't afford my own. And so the court-appointed attorney told me, "Well, you know, since it's the first time you've ever been charged with anything, you should be able to get off with probation, plead guilty, and that's it." So I said, "Okay, there's no problem with that." So we went to the court, and I went before the judge, and the judge said to me, he said, "Effing savages like you belong in jail." He was a real racist bigot. And he says, "I want you out of my courtroom. And if you think you're going to get probation," he said, "you're out of your mind, mister. You got 8 years." And I thought, wow, 8 years for a submarine sandwich is all I got out of that deal. Anyways, I found myself heading towards the big house. And it was scary because I was 17 years old. And you have to understand that there are some really brutal conditions in the penitentiary, because the second that we walk through the big house, and then you're in maximum security now, and then gates close behind you, that big clang just sends a serious shockwave through your nervous system, right all up and down your spine. Now you know you're playing for keeps. So this is the beginning of an 8-year sentence. The next brutal form of fascism is the chain of command by the prison guards. And what you have to, then the first next thing you experience is that you're shocked into believing, when you come from a detention center into the maximum security, you're shocked into the realization you have is that you can have absolutely no verbal contact with the police. And in fact, if you're going to move, you got to move by the command of what they call a nigger stick. They take the batons, they beat the stick against the wall once, and this is to move you out. And this means they tell you, when we beat this nigger stick once against the wall, this is when you move out, when you're in line. If you're caught talking, we will beat you to death right here. You're told this, and you're like, "What? Beat to death?" And all of a sudden, you're just thoroughly traumatized with trepidation that, you know, holy smokes, if I say something in line, they're going to kill me. And you can't believe it. You just think that there's a psychological game. But then all of a sudden, when somebody does talk or talk back, and then somebody got beat over the head, bludgeoned to death right there, 5, 6, 7 police beating them to death to show the rest of the inmates that this is the way we rule. We rule by terror. We rule by terror. Then if they want you to stop, they bang twice. So you can't ask no questions. And so the regimentation is there's a chain of command that goes from the sergeant to the lieutenant to the captain. It's a real military structure. The warden in the penitentiary is like the general. And one thing that I found, another fact that I found when I first went to Attica, was that the rural prisons were the guards in every prison were all rural whites. And there was absolutely no black or Latino or Indian native officers. They were all white. And they openly tell you that they belong to the Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazi organizations. And they tell you that they don't like niggers and that niggers will die if they get out of order. Now, you have to understand, 75% of the prison population was black. Latino, some indigenous, and then the rest was poor white working class. Some, very few blue-collar criminals in there. So this is a general atmosphere, and then the next phase of prison existence was you either work in the sweatshops, in industry, or you work in the prison mess hall, you work in the laundromat, and you are forced to work. The only way that you get out of work is if you go, if you're looking for a GED to go to school. But that's as far as you go, is a GED. You get a 12th grade education and that's it. But they basically after they orientate you, indoctrinate you into the prison through their orientation process. They basically do some kind of BS aptitude test, and then they say, well, you're better fit for industry. During that time in the 60s and going into the 70s, they were basically just beginning to establish a relationship with different corporations. There were 750 prisons in the United States at that time, and then the corporations decided, well, hey, this is a good way on contemporary levels, it's a good way to introduce or reintroduce the slave market, the slave industry. A modern day contemporary type plantations. And what it was is that if you went into the different shops, industries, and you created, whether it was license plates or whether you you made different kind of stuffs in the carpentry shop, and you made furniture, all this stuff the prison administration was taking out of the prisons and selling it to the streets outside. So in other words, they found it real expedient to pay us 2 cents a day for working 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, with one shower a week. At the end of a month, we got $3, just enough to get toilet paper, which you had to buy your own toilet paper, a bag of cheap garbage tobacco if you smoked, and a bar of soap, and some rancid toothpaste. Now, in order to organize at Attica and other prisons, you had to do everything clandestinely. Now, you have to remember also that it was during the time of the anti-war movement, the major demonstrations by the white left and the non-white left, and there was the Black Panther Party was coming into its own, and the Black Liberation Army, the Puerto Rican Liberation Fronts, and the indigenous movement was beginning to stir again. So what happened was is that there was a consciousness about anti-state, anti-authoritarianism. The women's movement was becoming very strong. People were fighting against racist mentalities. You know, they were challenging sexist mentalities, and people were definitely getting into the anti-colonial, anti-imperial consciousness during that phase. So a lot of the politicization was going on in the streets, and there was a whole new wave of people coming in from the streets that was beginning to saturate even the Black Muslims. You know, the Muslims, Islam, and you know, and Malcolm X and all these other fiery orators, you know, they were impacting from the outside, and people were coming in with a consciousness that was bucking authority. The people that were coming in, more militants were coming in from. And so all of a sudden, the prison administration had found that they could keep people complacent for the most part, with the rule by terror being challenged by militants left and right. Many militants were getting killed and murdered and buried in unmarked graves. Yet others of us that were coming in that weren't really politically conscious when we came in, you know, we're beginning to become politically conscious, and then we started meeting. Like, for instance, I always tell people, when I first went to Attica, I met a brother by the name of Sam Melville. He belonged to the George Jackson Brigade, and as well as the Weather Underground. He was known as the Mad Bomber. And when I started talking to him, he started telling me, you know, that we had to keep things in secrecy because you could only have three people at a time. Any more than three people talking at a time, you would be thrown into solitary confinement or beaten to death right there, or beaten brutally and hospitalized, and you don't get no medical care, so you just die slowly in the hospitals. And so he would start telling me about, you know, how the Weather Underground had been blowing up different military installations and corporate buildings, and how they started talking about the revolutions in Cuba, the revolution in Algiers, and started, you know, and just going around the world and started introducing us to this. So this was all orally done. But it was always said, and it would even write, like Sam Melville would write a lot of stuff, type it up, and then we'd fold it up, and we'd have to hide it underneath the poles in our beds and keep it under there and put the cap on so that if they come down, if they find this kind of contra, it's considered contraband. Anything to do with political consciousness, right, or revolutionary material. So whenever they found that, you would be brutalized to death and thrown in solitary confinement for months and years at a time. And they killed with impunity inside the penitentiary. I'm telling you, I witnessed 20 murders by the state, and many of those people, the families never even knew that their family was dead for years and years and years. And then they said that they escaped. So this is the kind of brutality that we live through. Now, in Attica, most people think, well, geez, they must have been really well organized for when Attica went down. But I can tell you, it was a situation that happened. Now, one of the main revolutionary leaders during that time that many of us were just like totally inspired by was George Jackson. He was one of the Soledad brothers in California, and he was in San Quentin Prison. And many of us had gotten his books. And many of the books we couldn't have it hard for because it was too hard to hide. So a lot of times people would mimeograph this stuff and bring it in. You had some guards that were sympathetic, you know what I mean? And basically decent, half-assed decent people. And they would bring in some material and they would bring in stuff that would be censored. One day on August the 16th, 1971, we heard that they had killed George Jackson in San Quentin. And that was like, you know, it was like, all of a sudden, everybody in the yard, black, white, Puerto Rican, Indian, came together and held a memorial service in complete defiance to the guards. Now, the guards came out up on the catwalks with guns and pointed them into the yard. And they said, disperse, disperse. And everybody said, to hell with you. Everybody stood there and everybody was there. You know, Muslims were making a prayer to honor him, the revolutionaries, the Black Panthers, everybody was there, said to hell with the state, and basically stood there and said a prayer, and then we dispersed. But when we did that, we tasted our own power in that solidarity, and it was a moment of solidarity. It was like, okay. And then we saw how shaken they got. Then there was another incident that happened a week later. There was a black brother and a white brother out in the yard. They were scrimmaging for a football game. And I was lifting some weights with on the Indian court. Now, everybody has their own courts, the native court, the white courts, the biker courts, the mafia courts, you know, everybody, handball courts, right? And everybody's got their own section, the Black Panthers. You know, everybody's got cliques, all right? There's all these different cliques in prison. And I was lifting some weights with this real big Indian guy named Lenny from Rochester, right? He's about 350 pounds. He's like 6'6". He's like just a beast, right? So Lenny and I are just pushing some weights in. This lieutenant came out into the yard with a bunch of guards and said, lock that fucking nigga up now. And the guards went to grab him, and the black brother turned around and said, man, you ain't locking me up, right? And then when they went to grab him, because they were scrimmaging for a football game, but they were saying they were fighting. So the black brother, by the name of Leroy Dewar, turned around and punched the guard, the lieutenant, right in the face. And then all of a sudden, when I'm lifting some weights, Lenny says, did you see that? I put the weights down. I said, no, I ain't seen that. Well, what was that? He said, man, that black guy over there just smacked that lieutenant in the face. Now, you know that's death. That's a death sentence right there. They're going to kill him. So all of a sudden, just as I was putting the weights out, I looked up, I watched the black guy hit him again. Popped him in the face again, and all these guards going at him, and then all of a sudden, it was just instantaneous. 400 inmates, all colors, just got up and circled all those guards. That was spontaneous. It was just as if it was a spontaneous move. So when we circled around him, and the lieutenant got thoroughly scared, the guards were like wide-eyed. They came out with the guns up on top, but we had them surrounded, so they didn't want to shoot into the yard. And so the lieutenant says some real simple bullshit. He says, well, I give you my word, my scout's honor, Eagle Scout's honor, that we won't lock him up. And that's when I came through the crowd and gave him a slap across the face and said, man, the hell with you and your Eagle Scout's honor, punk. So, and I was like fired up then, and they pulled me back through the crowd. This Italian guy named Johnny Anastasia pulls me back through the crowd and says, "Damn, young blood, man, they're gonna kill you." I said, "That's okay, let's get it on." Right? But I was just fired up, and so what happened was, they finally dispersed, everybody went back in. They promised not to lock those two guys up, then we went back to our cells. That night, they pulled the other two brothers out of their cells. All of a sudden, you could see at nighttime, you can see the floodlights, the silhouettes of the guards on the post at nighttime, the moon in the background through the bars. But then you can see one of the cell blocks. All of a sudden, there's all these fires going, and it's just inflamed all over the place. So when and you can hear all this screaming and yelling. What the brothers had done is when they tried to take some guy through a can of soup out his bars, when the guards came to take those two brothers out, the white guy and the black guy, to the box, and hit the guard in the head, his head was bleeding. And then everybody just started throwing paper out their cells, toilet paper, and lighting it on fire, all the kind of newspapers and lighting it on fire, bed sheets and everything else, and just general mayhem. The next morning, when everybody came out of our cells, we had heard that we knew this went down, but the word was, the prison grapevine was, hey, this could be it, the shit's going to hit the fan today, point blank. So, but we just knew. Now, this wasn't a pre-organized thing. This is happening by the day, but so many years of being oppressed, it's just like, and everybody thinking, this is spontaneous what'll happen when 1,200 oppressed men come together in this kind of situation, and all of a sudden, spontaneously, it was just time. Like, to see how much, what could be chaos and how quickly chaos turned into organized revolutionary organization. And so here we are. The next morning, we walk out the cells. We go into the mess hall. And the word was, everybody fast, take no food. Right? And the 1,200 men, we went into that dining room, the mess hall. Nobody ate except the diabetics. Usually you'd hear a ton of clang and banging, you know, with the clatter of the trays and the utensils, right? Now it's perfect quiet. The only thing you hear now, 100 guards against the walls with the keys. They're so damn scared you can hear his keys shaking. When that happened, and we could see how afraid they were, I always equate it with a lion who's been in the zoo and hadn't tasted blood for a long time. Then all of a sudden somebody throws him a steak. It's got that blood on it. And all of a sudden that he finds his instincts again. And for us, it was like we could smell their fear. And it was just like a total collective empowering. Black, white, yellow, red. It was just complete unity and a complete empowering at that moment. We started walking back down the hall. Now, the one unit that they used, there was a unit they called Five Block. Five Block was where the prison administrators were throwing the more militants. Now, I was on Nine Block, which was another way, but I was still just, I had only been in Attica for 16 days before it went down. I just came in from another rebellion over at Elmira Reformatory. So there was Nine Block and Five Block. We were walking back down the hall. When we got, usually when you get out of mess hall, you go out to the yard before you go to your slave assignments in industry. But the doors were closed. So when we stopped in the hallway, and when the captain and a bunch of guards comes walking down the hall, captain, one of the brothers, a Black Panther brother, said, "He said, how come those brothers got locked up last night?" And the captain says, "Well, I don't know, fellas." Well, you know, that's not the way they talked. "I don't know, fellas. You know, usually it's what's it to you, nigger? Bam." He said, "Well, I don't know, fellas, but we'll look into it." And the brother said, "Man, you full of shit, cracker." Boom! Smacked him right in the face, knocked him down. Sam Melville came in, kicked his ribs in, and that's when I turned around and said, "This is it. Take this motherfucking place now." So that was the spark. And before you knew it, the place just jumped. All of a sudden, you got 1,200 men in four different blocks moving through, grabbing sticks, grabbing pipes, pulling out shanks from everywhere. Everybody's strapped up, got shanks, start grabbing hostages, prison guards as hostages. Grab these guys, we started stripping them out of their clothes, their prison clothes, and put them in inmate clothes. So that when they, if they're going to assault us, they're not going to know who's who. So we put them in inmate clothes, so they look just like us. When we went down to the middle of the, there was all the four quarters come together. There was a place we call Times Square, like New York, right? Times Square. So right there, that's where all the gates and the halls converge. Now, in order to go from one gate to the next gate, or one yard to the next yard, yard A, B, C, and D, but there's these four quarters, they all meet at this central point, and there's four gates. There's guards on the inside that control the gates, so one different cell blocks, they have to open up the gate, close the gate when they go through, and then open up another. So they got full control at that point. The guards that were in there were four of them, they were scared out of their mind. They didn't want to open those gates, and we had to liberate the whole prison. Right now, it's just a block, the block we were in, that was totally liberated, and the rest of everybody, you can see them on the other sides, and everybody's moving in and rebelling, but we can't get through that gate. So all of a sudden, about 30 of us, well, maybe 30 to 60 of us, at any given time, this cast iron gate, the width of maybe 20 feet wide, that was encased in bricks. We kept pulling, shaking this gate. And all of a sudden, this gate just ripped right out of the brick walls. We just pulled it right out of the brick walls, and it collapsed, went down, hit one of the guards in the head, killed the guard. 2 days later, he died. But they accused me of killing this cop because I'm the one that yelled, "Take this place." So I was indicted for his alleged murder down the road. Then we seized the penitentiary when we opened it up. We took everybody into the prison yard, D block. We held the place with 50 hostages, and we instantaneously mobilized a coalition of men from every revolutionary group, every Muslim group, every body, every organization, or everybody had a representative on the negotiating team. We demanded immediately to be able to bring the outside media in, and the guy by the name of Russell G. Oswald, for the first time in history, granted that. That was their mistake. CBC, ABC, NBC, all the major networks were in there. New York Times, everybody. When they came in, the camera was on the inside for the first time in history. That was unheard of. Then we negotiated for 5 days with an elaborate representatives during the standoff, during the insurrection, and then we had observers like Louis Farrakhan, Senator John Dunn, Tom Wicker from the New York Times, Bill Kunstler, the famous civil rights attorney, came in, representatives from the Puerto Rican Liberation Party, the Black Panther Party, Bobby Seals came in. We just had a lot of people come in as observers to observe the negotiations between ourselves and the state of New York. Now, Russell G. Oswald was the main negotiator with us, and he was coming in and out. But there were other state negotiators that were coming in. And the thing about it was, is we began to negotiate for changes in the prison system. More money for our wages, better living conditions, an upgrade of the per capita, instead of 62 cents a day to eat. But then some of us who were becoming more militant, revolutionary minded and more militant, were saying like, the hell with making a terrible situation sweeter. Some of us said, hey, we want complete amnesty from any criminal prosecution. We want the immediate removal of those of us who are political prisoners. We want to be taken from this prison in a helicopter, and we want to go to a country, a non-imperialist country. And we had 17 countries in the world said that they would take us. 17 countries in the world said that they would definitely take us. Palestinians said they would take us. The Soviets said that they would take us. Cuba said that they would take us. Angola said that they would take us. We had revolutionaries. Vietnamese said that they would take us in and give us political asylum in a minute. So now the whole world is seeing Attica. So we've held them there for 5 days. And then Rockefeller, the governor, decided, well, we got to take this prison back. We got to take it back because, well, we just can't let this go on. Armed rebellion of the face that we have typed was their propaganda must be brought to an end immediately. Otherwise, it threatens the base from which a democratic society functions on. They wanted to negotiate this particular thing. Should we bring this up on the agenda for change as one of the demands? And then, brothers, there'd be a microphone system. Brothers, what do you feel about this proposition? And they bring the proposition, and then all of a sudden you'd hear, yeah, right? Or you'd hear, no, 1,200 men. So that was the democratic process there. So it was a consensus, a majority consensus. So Rockefeller, now a lot of people don't know, at the same time Attica was going down, and I didn't even know at that point, but there was a major confrontation going on in a place, one of the Iroquois nations called Onondaga, outside of Syracuse, New York. And apparently, New York State wanted to expand a highway going through the sovereign independent territory of Onondaga, Highway 81, and the Onondaga said no. And the Onondagas called on my people, the Mohawk, or the Ganyangehoga. That's what our real name is, Ganyangehoga, which means people of the land of the Flint in the Mohawk language. So they got an armed standoff. The Mohawks, 800 Mohawks, fully armed, ready to go toe-to-toe with the New York State troopers. We don't know. I don't know this is going on, but this is going on at the same time. And on September 13th, that morning, they gave us an ultimatum. They either give up the hostages or we're coming in. So I said, well, bring it on. Come on in. Psychological warfare now. And we've already got, we dug trenches. We've dug bunkers as best as we could in that yard. We've set up systems to urinate and defecate in these urinals, in these trenches. We've set up, we liberated the commissary for all the goods they had it in there. And we were making food from the commissary. Everybody was getting a portion. We even fed the hostages. You know, we fed them better than many of the people who were going, were hungry. But everybody ate something. Everybody had something to drink. And that morning they said that they're going to send in. They gave us the ultimatum. They cut the power off to the prison. But it's very important to understand what happened next. Because then all of a sudden, New York State troopers, that morning it was lightly raining. There was a light mist. We had been up all night long, and somebody, we just kind of knew something was going down. We had all our little fire camps going. Everybody, it was raining, and we had these barrels that we had our fires in, and we were, and brothers were saying, damn, brother, you know, if it goes down, man, he says, man, I hope I get buried next to you. The camaraderie was just, it was intense. The emotions, it was like we were crying. Like, it was like, you know, we had tears, and we were just like we knew something was going down. We knew it was coming down. We could feel it. And here we are, we're like crying. One brother said to me, he was crying, I says, and he was an older black brother, and I says, man, I said, brother, I said, what's the matter with you? And he said, man, brother, he said, you know, he said, this is the first time I've seen the stars in 32 years. And I said, what? He said, I've been here 32 years. And he said, the first time I've seen the stars in 32 years. He'd never been outside. He's looking at the stars and he's crying. Profusely crying. And it made me cry. And it just a welling of emotions, you know, because everybody was doing this, you know, and it was like this light rain was coming down. The next morning, when they closed the prison down and they were getting ready, all of a sudden we hear this. We see hundreds, 1,000 state troopers up on the walls, up on top of the prison. They got these red fluorescent raincoats on. They got their hats on. They got gas masks on. And we're pretending to hold these hostages there, threatening. Then all of a sudden, we hear this thunderous sound of an army helicopter flying over. Boom, 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 boom. And it flies over the hill. And there's somebody on there says, give up the hostages. Put your hands over your head. Surrender to an officer and you will not be harmed. And then all of a sudden the helicopter went over two more times. And we just kept saying, come on with it. Putting our clubs up in the air. Come on with it. We're not giving up. And all of a sudden, when they come over for the third time, they drop this big canister of CN4 gas. And it's a gas that was banned by the Geneva Convention of 1906 for cruel and unusual pain and suffering in the lungs and the eyes against the Vietnamese. And others, actually, they tried using it in Vietnam, but they also, the Geneva Convention pulled it out. But they used it on us. Then they got four more canisters come out of the air. Boom, boom, like in big barrels. And they exploded. So the whole yard is saturated with this gas. Now the media is outside saying, reporting as fact, that we had sliced hostages' throats, decapitated hostages, and castrated them. But eventually, the forensic expert in Rochester, in a press conference after the massacre, said that absolutely no guard had been cut with a knife at all. That everyone died as a result of state bullets. Going back into the prison, when those bombs went off, they took the guns. They had every kind of assault weapon you could possibly think of, including a 270 elephant rifle. And they fired 15,000 rounds of bullets into the yard. 43 people were killed, murdered in cold blood. I watched people's screaming, people's faces being blown off, guts spilling, and they're yelling with the gas masks as they're coming in, shotguns. One brother was holding up a Black Liberation flag. They shot him so many times, he just stood there. He wouldn't even fall. They put 200 rounds of bullets in him, and then they only fell when the bullets stopped. Sam Melville, they come yelling out his name. We're going to kill you, Melville. And they were yelling out people's names. And they came in. Sam Melville, they caught him. They blew his chest right out. So 43 people got killed. 80 people were wounded and maimed there for life. I come out of a building on the catwalk. State trooper puts a gun right in my face, pulls the trigger. The clip fell out. Two other state troopers smashed me across the face and threw me 35 feet down. And I landed right on a dead body and went unconscious for a minute before I come back. I heard that when that assault went down, some Mohawk friends of mine told me years down the road that something very strange happened inside the longhouse when they realized that they had gone back in and they killed people at Attica, and they said that there were some drums that were on the wall with the drumsticks, and all of a sudden these drums were being played by themselves, an honor song for the dead. People could see the stick hitting the drum like the spirit was playing an honor song for the dead so that the Mohawk and the old Onondaga could live. These people saw this so-called spectacle as a physical reality. So they killed 43 people. They made people strip naked after the massacre. There's bodies all over the place. People screaming. They snatched the hostages out. 11 hostages were killed by their own state bullets. They stripped everybody naked. Made everybody stand up in a line, walk around in a snake. Then they forced everybody to crawl on their hands and knees and elbows. And then they had this Sheriff's Department, D Division, from Buffalo. They were lined up in the quarter with tons of glass all over the quarter. And they were lined up on both sides with batons. and their guns. And then they forced everybody to run through the hallway, cut the feet, bleeding feet, and they were smacking everybody in the testicles and smacking people across the head. They took soapy water in the cells and they threw it out on the imitation marble floors. So when you hit the, when you're running down, you hit it, you start sliding. Then they beat you profusely and they packed four people naked in with, in to be taken in the cell together and retook the prison. And then in the middle of the night, during that whole day, when they retook the prison, they had marked X's on specific people's backs, scraped it, cut X's in their backs, pulled them out of their cells, and at nighttime took people down to the latrines, put their hands behind them, handcuffed them behind their back, stuck their faces inside the latrines, the shit and the piss, and they executed them all throughout the night. So then, months down the road, they took us all out of the prison, and they sent us all to different prisons, and I went to Comstock, a place called Comstock Prison afterwards. And then about a year later, they had been investigating, had a grand jury. They investigated 61 of us for being leaders, and for being leaders during the insurrection. And then they said that there was a combined total of the possibility of 25,000 years in jail for all of us. And I was facing the electric chair, plus 19 years for assaulting another cop. And death penalty was still alive at that time and still going. In 1973, while I was on trial, I was involved. I made bail, finally. And because they ruled the death penalty unconstitutional in 1973, so it made me eligible to go to get bail. And I had some non-native peoples put up their house for me to get out on bail, which was really beautiful. It was great. So I got out, and I was involved in another major standoff in Ginyonge, which was a place in upstate New York. And I have to say that we held that place for 9 months. Now, the organizers that originally went up there, the elders would say, well, we better not go into there and make this move because they'll do to us what they did to them brothers at Attica. But the younger guys said, no, just because of that, they might not move in so fast because the whole world is now saying, there's got to be commissions. We got to see what's going on. Rehabilitation programs, and everybody was just like, everybody has to see what's going on. Now the whole world is seeing what's going on behind prisons, and nobody else was looking behind before that. So anyways, it just so happens there was an incident. I was a part of the original 400 that went up there. And I was doing this while I was on bail. And nobody knew I was going back and forth on the weekends up there to this armed confrontation descent. So we were up there, held that place for like 6 months. A shootout happened one time where they shot into the camp. And we returned fire. Well, some people returned fire, and it just so happened they had a 9-year-old girl in the car with them. Now, why would you shoot into a armed Mohawk camp and take a little girl in the car with you, right? So I guess she got shot in the lower back, and she's okay, but, you know, she was shot. And that created this big fervor. And what happened was they sent in another 1,000 state troopers, started coming up this long, winding hill up into this place called Eagle Bay, Moss Lake at night. And just as the dusk, it was dusk, but you could see all this lights like it was a snake light, coming up this hill. But what we did was we got embedded on the sides. We put white sheets over our heads, progressive white sheets, put holes through it, and sat in 4 feet of snow. And we took little pine trees and wrapped them around our guns, and we sat camouflaged, 500 warriors. So as soon as all of the state troopers got within all of our checkpoints, then we put the guns right to the cop cars. And every state trooper damn near crapped on himself and peed his pants. Well, it just so happens that every state trooper that came up that same day were all the same pigs that went into Attica on September the 13th. We could have wasted them, but we didn't. Hugh Carey said, turn them around. I don't want Ginyonge to be my Attica. He seceded Rockefeller. So you see, now people say, well, how did you get away what happened? Well, I ended up getting 20 years of life for the most celebrated case, and I became the number one political prisoner at that time. I got 20 years to life. Newsweek magazine reported, unlike most murder trials, the trial of John Hill, Dr. Julia, or Split in the Sky, was completely bereft of evidence. I mean, they had no evidence. So here I am, 20 years of life, gone back in. I'm not even going to sit here and try to tell you about the 7 times they tried to murder me while I was back in, the cops, and would have murdered me. The only thing that kept me alive was that Nelson Rockefeller, who's ordered the massacre at Attica, was facing Senate confirmation hearings to be vice president under Gerald Ford, who had just given Nixon a pardon for his role at Watergate. Rockefeller comes in. He was getting nailed by the Democrats for the blood he's caused to spill at Attica. And subsequently, Rockefeller tried to get Anthony B. Simonetti to suppress any evidence going to a second grand jury that would have the state troopers indicted for the murders they committed and the executions they committed. A guy by the name of Malcolm Bell blew the whistle while they were trying to suppress this information. He blew the whistle. He went to the New York Times with a 60-page report. And this was during my trial. The New York Times held the information for the 60 days until after I was convicted before they released that information. So they withheld information to secure a conviction. This is the New York Times against me. So now I'm in prison for 4 more years. They have this big commission come down, and it took 4 years. The Bernard Shaw Commission was a former judge. Hugh Carey impaneled it, and after 4 more years and 7 attempts on my life, Hugh Carey makes the recommendation was to grant a blanket amnesty to all the state troopers and the guards that went into Attica with their own guns and killed with impunity, to give them a blanket amnesty so they got away with murder. To suspend the rest of the indictments against the 60 other Attica brothers, and in my case, to give me an executive clemency. Now, that meant that I was eligible, on the strength of a governor's recommendation, I was eligible to go to parole board right away and should have been released. The acting chairman of the New York State Parole Board was a black guy by the name of Edward Hammack. He hadn't been confirmed in the Senate. An assemblyman by the name of Dale Volker and a state legislator by the name of Ralph Marino petitioned on behalf of the Guards Union as well as the Police Benevolence Association, which threatened right across, all across the U.S., they threatened a major strike if I was released on bail, if I was released from prison. And the first time in the history of New York State, at the recommendation of a governor, I was given 2 more years to go to the parole board. By this time, I was called the lone scapegoat of Attica. By the time I went to the parole board, the next time in 1979, by the time I went there, Andrew Young had already called me the number one political prisoner out of 100 political prisoners in the U.S., with Leonard Peltier by that time was in, and Geronimo Pratt, and a whole number of other brothers and sisters, Marilyn Buck, and named us all. But we were, because Carter was saying there was no political prisoners in the U.S., and then by that time, all the major media was saying that I was a sole scapegoat of Attica. And then on top of that, Ramsey Clark worked voraciously to get me out as my appeal lawyer. And eventually, in May of 1979, I was released. Well, Attica, what it empowered. It re-empowered the oppressed. Because, I mean, for years after that, I mean, we got bold. All prisoners used to say, the cops fuck with them. Yeah, you motherfuckers, what do you want, another Attica, motherfucker? That's the way we said it. What do you want, another Attica? Because you will get another Attica. It empowered people to say, hey, fuck you. Fuck you and your system. And then, you know, I mean, when even Black September, they had a big sign out there, remember Attica. You know, I mean, all over the world, people said, Attica, Attica, Attica is all of us. Attica means fight back. It became a major axiom, posters and so, all over the world. Nobody died in vain. No. Because you know what we did? At that point, it was, it really, if you look at it, it was a 20th century slave rebellion of the oppressed of all colors, of all walks of life, including the white working class. It was a phenomenal revolution. It was a big sacrifice, but it was not in vain. Because here we are, almost 33 years later, and we're still talking about it. It's history that's not going to go away. It's just not going to go away. Attica is all of us. Attica means fight back.